Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, greetings to all of you from Florida's Space Coast. I am Jim Behnke, and you're listening to the October 10th, 2009 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance, innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, you are invited to join in the conversation today at any time during the next hour by calling 768-1240, star 1240 for the local AT&T wireless customers here along Brevard County. And if you're out of town, give us a call anytime. 321 is the area code, 321-768-1240. We're also keeping an eye on AOL. And if you have questions or comments, you can send them to us at spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, this has been a very interesting week for me, and I guess I have to admit that I am both emotionally drained and charged up all at the same time. You know, if you're a regular listener, you happen to just know me well, you know that my passions include the space program and my beloved Minnesota Vikings. And so my week this week began incredibly well with the Vikings beating the Green Bay Cheesehead Packers on Monday Night Football. It was the big game, if you heard about it, in which the future Hall of Fame quarterback Brett Favre came out on the field wearing purple and led the Vikings in victory over his former team. It was great. I was flying high, had a great Tuesday. It was just a lot of fun. And, you know, all is right with the world. And then I started seeing in the media the preview stories about the L-Cross spacecraft hitting the moon on Friday morning. And that's not quite right. Let me rephrase that. I started seeing stories about how NASA was going to bomb the moon. Oh, my gosh. The space agency was going to shoot a missile at the moon. I mean, how dare we? You know, we might disrupt, I mean, a big explosion, you know. We might disrupt the moon's orbit and wreak havoc on the Earth. And our tides are going to change. And we're all going to die, basically. And by the way, who gave us permission to shoot the moon? I mean, isn't the moon, you know, like controlled by somebody or owned by somebody? I mean, how can we be so arrogant as just to shoot the moon like that? You know, and we're bombing the moon? Are we militarizing space? Is this all about weapons? And this is a conspiracy. This is a secret military test of a bomb on the moon, not just NASA trying to do science, you know. And of course, even if you don't believe in any of that, then you might as well just believe that we're wasting money. I mean, I heard these people asking these questions. Why are we wasting so much money looking for water on the moon when we have so much water right here on Earth? You know, and it just okay. So, I mean, just that's just the start. So, I love David Letterman. Despite the trouble he's going through, he's my comedian of choice for late night, and I'm a loyal watcher. But you know what? He starts out with the jokes. And they weren't even really jokes. If you actually listen to the words he said, they were never anything. It was not a joke. It was just making an editorial comment with a little sarcasm thrown in. You know, in fact, at one point, and it was relentless. It was relentless about L-Cross as he's been about Brett Favre, to tell you the truth. And it even inspired him and his writers to write a top 10 list this week about the top 10 signs that NASA's leader is going crazy. And, you know, while the 10 jokes themselves were, you know, usual borderline funny in terms of the top 10 list, they weren't really cheap shots. They weren't based on anything, you know, wrong. They were just trying to be funny. But nevertheless, it just kept coming. Okay, so then the television anchors and the commentators weighed in. And although their words, again, were mostly accurate, you couldn't miss the sarcasm in their tone of voice. You know, see their eyes roll in disbelief when they're talking about this. I mean, even my former boss, Lou Dobbs, who I have a great deal of respect for, he's a big supporter of the space program. He was the founder of space.com. I worked for him for a couple of years. He took a pot shot at L-Cross, suggesting that NASA should stop wasting time on such novelty stunts as this and get back into the business of real exploration. And I'm thinking to myself, does anyone understand what this experiment was all about. It is all about exploration. It is all about looking for water on the moon. And if we can find water on the moon, then we can do things at the moon that we can't think we can do right now. And it's all about the future. So then there was the event itself. Okay, well, boy, that was mixed bag, wasn't it? The 30,000-pound Centaur stage slams into the moon right on time, right on the mark, followed 4 minutes later by the L-Cross spacecraft. You know, a crater was formed. Infrared cameras did detect the heat signature of the explosion, of the impact. But because it wasn't the big visual spectacle like everyone has seen in the movies, you know, you hit the moon and suddenly there's all this orange flame and orange fire, you know, which comes, by the way, kerosene burning and oxygen. So I don't know how that would work on the moon anyway. But you didn't see the big explosion. You didn't see the big plume. You didn't see this big, bright, flying flash of a light and spewing dust and debris and a big mushroom cloud. I think they were all expecting maybe a mushroom cloud over the moon or something like that. You know, it didn't happen. And so obviously these network commentators and these TV folks and these slightly trained news media people, you know, it failed, right? Because they can tell. They didn't see anything, so obviously it failed. And it wasn't even that. It was just they were incredulous that there wasn't a picture, because this was TV, and TV only works when there's pictures. You notice that sometimes on the news, the only reason it's on the news is because there's a picture to go with it. If the picture wasn't there, it wouldn't have been news. So, I've been part of the news media for years, and I understand the mentality, and I've had to deal with it, and that's okay. We can have a whole other discussion on that another day. But it did kind of make me just kind of like incredulous to believe that, okay, let's think about this. If they're spending their whole week making fun of it and saying what a stupid thing it is to do and how wrong it is and what a waste and blah, 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 then they also broke in live coverage, every one of them, to cover it live and be there with the pictures. And so, you know, boy. So what's all this leave us? Where does all this leave us at the end of the week now? A week that for me started great and ended kind of funky. Well, it's going to end great now because I'm going to have a great discussion today on the show, and then tomorrow we're going to watch the Vikings beat the Rams. So this is going to be a good weekend, you know. But for me, the bottom line of L-Cross is this, that what you need to know is that this inexpensive mission, and it was $79 million, which is a lot to you and me and would pay all the bills, but is a drop in the bucket when it comes to anything the government does. Sought to reveal evidence of water on the moon. L-Cross sought to do that, and I think it's gonna prove that one way or the other. There's been evidence that there's water on the moon, and I think we're gonna see in this spacecraft that will continue. But unfortunately, the plume raised by L-Cross, which wasn't so visible, did reveal, you know, to me again, with some of the worst things not only about our news media, but frankly about the science literacy of this nation, if not the overall intelligence of the masses, critical thinking, asking the questions, taking time to understand the answers, and not just look at a headline that says bomb the moon and then base everything that you want to think about just those words, bomb the moon. There's a lot more to it than that. Now, I don't usually get this cynical, but this whole L-Cross episode has just put me in a mood and reminds me of what I have often said before about that, you know what, well, here's what I believe. I don't want to save the planet. I want to escape it. I just want to get off the planet, move on, and go do something new. The pilgrims of the 21st and 22nd century, it's going to happen all over again. We're going to go out into space, and we're going to go do something new. Well, before we can go do some of those new things, before we can escape the planet, we're going to need a new launch vehicle to do that on. And guess what? How's that for a segue? We're going to be talking today about the Ares 1X test flight that's going to be taking off from the Kennedy Space Center here in about 17 days, if all goes well. And we've got a couple of guys from NASA Kennedy Space Center here to talk to us about that mission and give you a complete and full preview of what's going to be a very busy couple of weeks ahead here. And we'll be making a lot of news about this topic in our paper and in our media. So we're going to get smart on it, and so we all know what we're talking about. So a reminder to you that your calls are welcome anytime, 321-768-1240. 1240 AT&T wireless customers, spacetalking@AOL.com. I'm Jim Behnke. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. We're back in a few seconds.
It's an Endeavour World Program. Roger, roll, Endeavor.
Now is the time for shuttle program employees to chart a new course.
O-3-T-S-O.
A course that will take their careers beyond the last space shuttle mission to new job opportunities and horizons.
Fine, let's go.
Brevard Workforce is helping our community shuttle engineers, technicians, and administrative workers to launch new careers through the Aerospace Workforce Transition Program.
Houston, flight is go.
While they continue to safely launch the remaining shuttle missions. Through the programs, resources, and services, aerospace workers can map out a strategy, undergo skill assessments, take workshops, update degrees and certifications, or receive education funding. Assistance is available and ready.
PTC, let's go.
Contact Brevard Workforce today and take the first easy step to prepare for a successful post-shuttle career in aerospace or other industries.
The launch team is ready to proceed.
Call Brevard Workforce at 394-0556. That's 394-0556. Visit them online at launchnewcareers.com or Twitter them at launchcareers.
You are go for launch.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
Well, and welcome back to Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. Once again, your call is welcome here at 321-768-1240 or star 1240 on the AT&T wireless customers, or send us email to spacetalking@aol.com. And let's get into it now, because right now, inside the vehicle assembly building, a new rocket, more than 300 feet tall, stands on a mobile launcher platform. And if all goes well, as we said before, within the next 17 days, we'll see a brand new launch vehicle lift off from the Kennedy Space Center. And one of the managers of this program at the Kennedy Space Center, with the big smile on his face right now with the way things are going, is John Cowart, a veteran KSC program manager who is now deputy mission manager for the Ares 1X test flight. And good to see you, John. Welcome to the program.
I am really happy to be here talking about 1X.
Yes, it's going to be good. And also, we just want to let you know, he may stay a little quiet in the background here, but also with us in the studio to join the conversation is our own favorite George Diller from NASA Public Affairs.
Jim, thank you. It's good to be with you
good.
Again.
George, arguably the best launch commentator on the planet, and he'll be doing this launch as well. So thanks for coming in. John, let's not dwell too much on the background, but I think we want to make sure everyone in our audience is up to speed on what we're talking about. So give us the quick update and introduction to the Ares 1 vehicle and a real brief overview of what this test is all about.
Well, Ares 1X was first conceived really back in October of 2005. That's the first time somebody mentioned anything about what would eventually become the Ares 1X rocket. As you know, we're going to go fly the Ares 1 eventually, and that's supposed to be our crew vehicle where we will launch the crews up into space. And in order to get ready to go fly that vehicle, we thought we would try just a basic flight test. It's a proven concept. They use this all over, and especially you see it a lot in the aircraft world. What we want to go do is fly a prototype very similar to, but not identical to, the rocket that we're going to need when we take the humans up. And so that became Ares 1X, and the X, of course, is a testament to experimental test flight. Mm-hmm. You get back into the history of that. So when they came up with that, we've done a whole lot of studies for about a year and a half, and then finally, in about August of 2006, we really started getting into the design of this rocket and the way this mission would fly and the things that we needed to go do that. So since then, we finished all of our design. We have manufactured. We have put it together. We have tested it. And as you keep saying, we are 17 days away from launching this thing. And what it's going to do, it's got 725 sensors on board. These sensors will give us a lot of good data that we can use to tell us how the real Ares 1 rocket will fly when it goes up. And so one of our guiding principles on this was we wanted to fly at least 6 months prior to the critical design review for the Ares 1 rocket. That's when they're at about the 90% level in their design. We wanted to fly at least 6 months before then so that they could take our data and use that in order to make their rocket better. So that's our criteria, and we're going October 27th.
So let's take it back a little further now. So previous President Bush in 2004 announces the vision for space exploration. We made the national policy decision to retire the space shuttle program. 2010 was the time then, and we're going to be pretty close to that, I think. And we're going to need some new launch vehicles to go do the new mission. So a study was done, and the decision was made that, well, we need two new launch vehicles to do the job of getting us back to the moon and on to Mars. And Ares 1 was one of them, and the Ares 5 was the other one, the heavy lifter.
Right, that's the heavy lifter that's going to take the Earth departure stage and the lunar module, which we call Altair. It's going to get those up into Earth orbit and be the thing that actually takes us to the moon.
And Ares 1 need to come first because you have the Orion capsule on top, and you want to get to the space station and back. And
right. We want to do that for a few years, gain a little experience, and then we'll use that because we're using a five-segment solid rocket booster on an Ares 1. We'll use that on the Ares 5, and it really is a very incremental way of building upon your knowledge and your experience. It's just like we did it back with Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. You build upon your experience, and that's what we're trying to do again.
Yeah, and I think that's a key point that I want to make here, too, is that, you know, when everyone in the space program today, the space community, the general public knows the shuttle. It's been in our lives for the last 25, 30 years. And so we remember STS-1 being the very first flight of the shuttle with two guys on board, John Young and Bob Crippen, who you know, there was no test flight.
That's right.
They got in, they light the fire, and away they went. Of course, what people forget with Apollo, for example, is the Saturn V went through, 10 Saturn I's and then another bunch of Saturn I-Bs, and then
two Saturn V launches before we put humans on board.
So you know, and of course they had the money and the time, and it was a different era and all that, and I'm sure that's all part of the trade-off. I'm sure you'd love to have 10 Ares 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D, you know, fly.
That's correct.
Before you get to the
real
thing.
But what we've done is we've parsed it down and made it incremental and what we can afford to go do, and this is what we get.
So the Ares 1X, going again back to the Ares 1, because you had to get the Kennedy Space Center ready for the Ares 1 rocket, and the 1X, of course, is the test flight. So talk a little bit about how what's different at the Kennedy Space Center now is you took some shuttle facilities and turn them into Ares facilities. How long has that been in work? Is that all done now that this rocket's ready to fly?
It is essentially done. A very good point is, as I've said, we are trying to do this as quickly and cheaply as we can. This is just a flight test. There are no humans on board. The upper stage is just a simulator. So we wanted to do this as inexpensively and as quickly as we could. So in order to do that, you want to minimize the modifications that you have to do to your facilities, because when we were going to originally fly this flight, which was back in April, we would not have time to do a lot of the modifications you want to do for the real Ares 1 rocket. So what can we do really, really quickly? Well, within the vehicle assembly building, you know, the big 525-foot tall building out there, we are, for the real Ares rocket, we're going to put whole new platforms inside the building. Well, there was certainly no time to go get that done and still process shuttles in that same building.
Right.
So what we've done was, in order to have access to the entire stack, we built the access internal to the rocket. So you can get into the rocket about halfway up, and then you get to the top of it climbing ladders and stuff inside.
Really, inside. Okay.
Yeah, it was just a very innovative, and it was one of those things where KSC, Kennedy Space Center, said, guys, we have a really good idea that'll save you a lot of money. If you'll just build the platforms inside the rocket, since there's not a liquid oxygen or liquid hydrogen tank, we'll save a ton of money on temporary platforms to get you up there. So we did that. So we've modified. We actually, in the vehicle assembly building, we had to take really a three-story building out of there, because on the Ares 1X rocket and on the Ares 1, about halfway up, it gets wider.
Right.
And by virtue of that, we're sitting in a left-hand solid rocket booster hole on a traditional mobile launch platform. Once again, we're using what we've got.
Right.
And because it gets larger there at the top, that building that we have inside the VAB would prevent us from rolling out the door. So we had to take that entire thing, that entire three-story structure, out of the VAB. Mm. So that was the major modification we did in there, along with adding a new circuit to provide cool, breathable air inside the rocket. On the mobile launch platform, really simple stuff. We added some cleats down there. We have to add some water bags to help. There's an empty right-hand solid rocket booster hole. We don't want the echo coming up through there and hitting our rocket. It's bad acoustics for us. So we're going to add some water bags. We did that. Inside, we've added some more computer stuff that goes with our rocket, not with the shuttle. Mm-hmm. And then at the launch pad are the biggest modifications that everybody's going to see. And obviously the most visible things that have been done are we removed the GOX vent hood, you know, that beanie cap that used to be out there.
Sure, the big arm.
This is the interesting thing for people, to give you a sense of perspective. When you go out there and you see that beanie cap now still over there on pad A, we took that off of ours because that's about halfway up our rocket.
Yeah.
So we're going to stick way up above there. Yeah. We had plans for putting an extension on our lightning mast out there at the pad, because the lightning mast that they use for shuttle is about 20 feet shorter than our rocket.
Right.
So we were providing excellent lightning protection for the pad, which is not what we wanted to do.
Right.
So we had time. We built the three big towers out there. And then the other big thing you'll notice is we took the orbiter access arm down, and in its place we put what we call the vehicle stabilizer system, or the VSS. And this is the thing, when the rocket finally gets to the pad, Ares 1X, this thing with these giant claws reach out and grab the rocket and hold it steady so that we're good and safe out there in winds up to 65 miles an hour.
Wow. So let me ask you, you're in the VAB and you're working up high like that. Did you run across anything from Apollo that was interesting?
Well, I know
you were surprised to find, or
I was surprised the elevator still went up that high, because
okay.
You got to remember the shuttle stack is only about half as tall as a Saturn V, and it's at its highest point it's 184 feet, and the Ares 1X is 327. So
yeah.
you're taking the elevators up into regions that they have not often gone.
Did you see anything that has been maybe not been touched up there for years and years, whether it was Apollo or something
else? I saw
an
awful lot of dust.
A lot of dust. You know, I'll tell you a quick story. One day we went over, when I was back in Florida today, we went on a tour of the VAB. Bill Johnson took his keys and gave us a nice tour of the VAB. Mike Brown and I went. And we're looking for unusual things, and it was stupid stuff. Like, we opened a door, and there was a broom and a mop pan. Now, you know, it might have been sitting there for 30 or 40 years. We don't know. You know, it just looked like it had been there forever. We went off on one floor, came around the corner, and there was like 100 urinals sitting on the floor. Had been taken out of some building somewhere and just stored there.
Yeah, the VAB is full of stuff that is stored from other places. You can go all around and see stuff like that.
I wondered if there had been anything kind of weird like that.
No, I didn't run across it personally, no.
No, okay, good. Well, all right, so the VAB's got some modifications to it. The mobile launcher platform is essentially the same with some extra stuff to fill in the holes.
Yeah, not much there.
When it rolls out now, same exact procedure as we got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, when we roll out, we will go unsupported. What you're going to see is the 327-foot tall rocket rolling out unsupported except by the four hold-down posts there. And we take it at 0.8 miles an hour out to the pad, just like shuttle does. We get there. We got to navigate that grade to get up there.
Mm-hmm.
And once we're at the top of the pad slope, the vehicle stabilizer will reach out and grab it and hold it steady.
Okay. We're going to talk a little bit more about that one. We're going to pause right now, take what we like to call our five-minute built-in hold here. We're going to be back in a little bit, get updated on latest news, weather, sports. We'll return more with our conversation with John Coward and George Diller. You are listening to WMMB. I am Jim Banky. This is Space Talk, once again brought to you by our sponsor, United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
If it's happening in space, Jim Banky is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
Well, and welcome back to the second half of Space Talk on WMMB. I am Jim Banky, and today we're talking about the Ares 1X test flight, targeted launch from the Kennedy Space Center. I guess it's fair to say no earlier than October 27th. An official launch date will be set at some time in the near future at the conclusion of a formal flight readiness review held at the Kennedy Space Center by senior NASA officials. How many times have I written that in my career as I look at George Diller laughing here in the studio? Before we return to our conversation with our guests, with NASA's John Coward and Mr. Diller, I want to remind you that you can stay in touch with this program throughout the week by going to WMMBAM.com online. And there you can always hear live streaming of the program. Right now it's being streamed live on the Internet. If you shouldn't be at a radio, you can listen to anywhere. During the week, you can download a podcast of the previous week's program. Someday soon we'll have the complete archive available, but for now it's always the previous week is available for a week. You can type in the keywords Space Talk at the top of the WMMBAM.com webpage, and that'll take you directly to our Space Talk show webpage. And there I occasionally will post updates on guests as we get them confirmed. Sometimes we'll put up a little bit of space news there if there's something really interesting going on that I want you to be aware of. And certainly any time that we have links to websites that we mention on the program, we certainly will put those online for you to make it convenient for you to follow up on what we've been talking about. In fact, right now I would encourage you to visit the page when you get a chance. You'll see a new link there about sending letters to President Obama in support of our space program, an effort started by Brevard County Commissioner Robin Fisher. We talked about it last week's program. That effort continues, and I encourage all of you to pen a letter and send it off to the president. And if you need some help on doing that or some suggestions, again, go to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and you'll see the link there to that website, and they'll take care of you from that point. Well, let's get back into our discussion about the Ares 1X again with John Cowart and George Diller. And, George, I want to talk to you from a public affairs standpoint for a moment. The rocket is scheduled to roll out in the wee hours of the morning, October 19th now?
Right, that's a week from Monday.
Week from this Monday. And give us a little background on what's going to happen and maybe what the public can expect to see or how the public can see this rocket on the pad for the next couple weeks.
When we roll out, it will be, of course, in the middle of the night. 12:01 a.m., of course, is completely dark, and we do that for a reason, because we get the best weather. We think we have the least chance for lightning and the best chance for the lowest wind. So
right. It's
pretty much a weather-driven decision. So we all want to see it, of course. So the plan is to bring some of the xenon lights that we use at the launch pad to light up the shuttle when it's dark and we're launching at night, and focus them on High Bay 3 of the Vehicle Assembly Building on the east side, so when it rolls out, it'll be completely lit.
Right.
And we will carry it live on NASA television. If we roll out at 12:01 as we currently plan, then we'll start our coverage around 11:45.
Okay.
And we'll follow it rolling out until it eventually rolls out far enough from the Vehicle Assembly Building and it sort of disappears into the darkness.
Okay.
When it arrives at the pad in the morning, which will probably be, if we're able to maintain that 8/10 of a mile an hour speed, which is our current plan. We're going to be looking at that as we go along and make sure that that's the speed we want to continue
to maintain.
It's
a taller rocket, but a lighter rocket than the shuttle, so you're thinking a little more mileage out of there. I don't know, mileage is the right word. mileage per hour, gallons per minute, or whatever
well,
it is.
We're going to be looking at stresses on the vehicle.
There you go.
That's the driver, right?
Yeah.
But we should get there if we maintain that speed. We won't have to stop anywhere along the way. Get there probably around 6:30 in the morning, which will be just before sunrise. So if the sun comes up, then we're going to resume our coverage on NASA television, and you'll have some live pictures, we hope, of the Ares going up the ramp at pad 39B and going up on top. And the rotating service structure will be open for a couple of hours till we put it in place, which its primary purpose for 1X is going to be access. And it'll stay closed until we get to around 5 days or so before launch, when we'll pull the rotating service structure back from about noon one day until about 9 p.m. the following night to do a series of tests. So that will be an opportunity if you're looking at the launch pad, since it's so much taller than the structure itself, you'll be able to see some of it sticking up above the launch.
That's right. So we're used to right now when the shuttle goes out and the rotating service structure covers the orbiter, we can see the external tank, the solid rocket boosters. And anyone taking the bus tour at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, very used to that scene. Now with Ares 1X out on the pad, and you mentioned the RSS rotating in place, we're going to see a lot more of the rocket. Obviously, the thing's sticking up out of the top, as you just said. Other opportunities then, I guess that first Monday morning would be a great chance to go out and see the whole rocket on the pad.
And again, when we pull it back for that testing, if you're on the visitor gantry that day,
you could see it really well. Okay.
Right.
John, let's get into the launch itself and the mission itself. Take us through the countdown, the launch. What are we going to see? I'm sitting there on the Indian River in Titusville. I'm down at Jetty Park. This is a taller rocket, yet it's skinnier.
Right.
So, there's a trade-off there, if you will. It's going to be spewing out smoke because it's a solid rocket booster, so we'll be able to at least track it that way. But take us through the mission and how long it's going to take, and what are we going to see from a public standpoint?
Well, what you're going to see on launch day is our countdown begins at 1 o'clock in the morning, and it will last 7 hours with a T0 right at 8 a.m. That is our preferred launch time. The drivers for our launch time are that we have to have daylight. We want to get good video of this since it is a test flight.
Absolutely.
When you see the rocket flying, you'll see it's got a unique stripe, what we call the Z stripe, painted on there because we want the cameras to see it and know how the vehicle is oriented as it's ascending through the atmosphere. That's key for us to know what it was doing. But as the countdown starts, not a whole lot of activity visible to people. There is no fueling of the external tank. There's no liquid hydrogen, no liquid oxygen. So it looks very quiescent
right. Compared
to a normal shuttle. You're not going to see smoke billowing out from any vents or anything like
right. That.
We have purge going in there, keeping the electronics inside the rocket nice and cool. Finally, about 2.5 hours prior to launch, we will disconnect all those cooling ducts. We're getting the pad finally secured. Disconnect those cooling ducts. You'll see the GOX vent arm, which is used for shuttle. That's our highest access point. You'll see that rotate back. You'll also see the rotating surface structure, which gets us to another access point just a little bit lower on the rocket. You'll see that retract at about 2 hours to go.
Wow.
And with that, so really only for about the last hour and a half of the countdown is the rocket fully exposed for everybody. And finally, it's just a normal count. We have a hold at T-minus 4 minutes.
Okay.
The reason being is we're using Atlas Heritage Avionics on board. Once again, all about cheap and quick.
Okay.
So we're using their avionics. They know they'll fly the rocket. Hold at T-minus 4 minutes for about 15 minutes.
15 minutes, okay.
And then we count down, and at T-zero, if all is well, we're going to go. Now, we have a four-hour window on this rocket, and that is not driven by, obviously, any crew on the back time or any orbital parameter we have to go meet. This is a suborbital flight, and what we're looking for, the reason we have that 4 hours, is the electronics. In fact, we just did a test this week to test the thermal in there, see how quickly the boxes heat up.
Mm-hmm.
You have a certain amount of time. So if we have 2 hours without purge on it before launch, we have 4 hours in a launch window, and then another 2 hours to get the purge hooked back up, we figured that's about how long the electronics will go without any purge air on
heating.
Them. So that's what drives us with that 4 hour window. So actually, we could see, you know, if something scrubs us early on, we could have at least another launch attempt on the same day.
You could. Okay, that makes sense. And the range can support that in terms of clearing
and all
that?
And the range will support that. The range has cleared us from 8 to noon.
From 8 to noon. Are they able to handle a launch? Could you, I don't know if scrub is the right word, but if you found a problem very early on in the countdown and you held there, for example, and now you said, well, we can make a run at launching at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
That question came up the other day in our launch readiness review, and the way the range is structured – they don't like to respond to that kind of a real-time thing.
Right.
So we're going to go back and talk to them again and see if that might be possible. We really think 4 hours is going to be more than adequate for whatever comes up.
Plenty, yeah.
Right.
I mean, as complicated as it is, and it's rocket science and all of that, it's a relatively, and I don't know if you're going to hit me now, relatively simple rocket.
What makes it so much simpler, of course, is that we don't have the human systems on board. We don't have to make sure that there are 7 human beings that will be perfectly cared for. And that also simplifies it for us in terms of the weather. We don't have to have return to launch site weather.
Right.
We don't have to have good weather in Zaragoza, Spain, or somewhere in France. We don't have to have good weather out in California for an abort once around. So in several ways, yes, it is simpler. It is still an awful lot of energy.
Right.
I mean, this thing's going to go from zero to about 3 million pounds of thrust in half a second.
That's right.
So it's going to make a lot of smoke and fire, and it is dangerous.
Let me ask you quick about the weather, because that's a good point. You mentioned the Atlas Avionics. Are you using standard Delta Atlas Titan unmanned launch vehicle
No, we don't use it. We have those. Those are derived specifically for us based upon our launch vehicle and the way it reacts. We've done modal testing that tells us how this rocket will behave during ascent.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, just We've done all the math. We've done all the analysis. We've done the wind tunnel. It's time to go fly. It's just like a baseball game. We all think somebody's going to go win, but
right.
You got to go play the game.
Well,
to
that's
find
just
out.
Like, but I want to ask about the weather. It's clouds, lightning trigger, rocket triggered lightning rules, anvil rules, all that kind of stuff.
All of that is essentially the same as far as sky and cloud conditions. Actually, they're a little bit better for Aries in terms of how much clearance you have to stay within clouds that have potential to have a charge on.
Okay.
But the wind limit is going to be about 20 knots.
20 knots.
Okay.
Pretty consistently.
Okay.
Yep.
So you could launch into a cloud if it's the right kind of a cloud.
Oh, yeah, if it's just cute and fluffy. Yeah.
George is not so convinced.
You know, a lot depends on whether, you know.
How many of them there are.
How many of them there are.
How it is and whether it extends into the
through
freezing
the freezing layer in the chart.
Right.
And all of that, getting a little too technical here. All that has to do with what's called rocket-triggered lightning. There are conditions of clouds that if you launch through, the rocket and its plume could actually trigger a bolt of lightning, and you do not want a bolt of lightning hitting your rocket. Apollo 12 was very lucky to have
exactly
that happen
right.
to him and make it through, but other rockets have not been so lucky in the past. Well, look, we're going to take another quick little break here, just a couple of minutes, and come back and finish our conversation with John Cowart and George Diller. This is Space Talk on WMMB, sponsored by United Space Alliance. We'll be back in just a few seconds.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
And again, welcome back to Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance, here in our final moments with John Cowart and George Diller from NASA, talking about the Ares 1X test flight scheduled for launch October 27th. It is a show not to be missed. 8 a.m. in the morning, please be up looking in the sky for this thing. It's going to be absolutely incredible. We, of course, here at WMMB will bring live launch coverage to you. John, talk about the launch itself. How fast does it get off the pad? Basically, take us through the mission, and again, from the perspective of what are we going to see in our sky that day?
Well, obviously, what's going to happen as you get down near T-0, as I said, we have the hold at T-minus 4 minutes. You press on down around T-minus 25 seconds. You'll start the APUs, the auxiliary power units that are in the bottom of the solid rocket booster. These are the things which will provide the hydraulic pressure that you need in order to steer the rocket. They'll move the nozzle. And then at T-0, we blow those four hold-down nuts that are holding the rocket to the ground, and it goes from 0 to 3 million pounds of thrust in about half a second, and up it goes. Now, we're going to clear those three new lightning towers we had. They're about 620 feet tall. We're going to clear that tower in less than 6 seconds. The rocket will ascend fairly straight up. It'll begin a pitch over about 8 seconds into the flight. It'll also do a roll maneuver. Okay. Which is exactly what a real Ares 1 rocket is going to do. And we have a roll control system on here that will help us do that. Mm-hmm. And it's going to pitch over and again, heading due east. It's not going north like a shuttle does when it's heading toward the space station. We're going to go due east out of here.
Now, real quick here. Now, so as it gets off the ground and clears the towers in 6 seconds, how fast is that related to what we'll see in the shuttle? Is that the same speed kind of generally, a little faster?
We're coming up just a little bit faster. Most folks will probably not notice a difference, but it's a 1.8 million pound rocket with 3 million pounds of thrust.
Okay.
Now, I will tell you that we go supersonic in 39 seconds.
Okay, and that's a little faster.
That's impressive. The shuttle takes right around a minute to get to that speed.
And the roll and the pitch maneuver, again, as dramatic as we see a shuttle rolling on its back?
Because this is a cylindrical rocket, it will not be as noticeable, but you will see it heading up and east.
Four-segment booster burns out in 2 minutes, and then what?
What's going to happen then is on the rocket, I know the audience doesn't have a rocket in front of them to look at, but when you see pictures of it, you notice you have the solid rocket booster portion, and then it gets a little bit thicker. There's this, what we call the snow cone part of the frustum in our NASA ease.
Okay.
At the frustum, right underneath that is where we separate. Now, then the upper part, the upper stage, then just becomes a giant lawn dart.
Okay.
And it's going to head out and hit the ocean about 140 miles out, break up into a million pieces. We had to prove to the Coast Guard that that would happen. They did not want it to become a hazard to navigation.
Right.
The first stage, the four-segment solid rocket booster, along with a simulated fifth segment on there, that is now going to have new parachutes, just like the real Ares 1 rocket. These are pretty much identical to what the real Ares 1 rocket is going to use. They will deploy just as they would on a real Ares 1 mission, and it'll come down about 120 miles out into the ocean, splash down, and we're going to have the ships out there to recover this one just like we do for the shuttle.
So when you think of the solid rocket boosters coming off the shuttle, we always see those boosters come off, and then they kind of fade into the distance, and we don't see them so much. And of course, the NASA TV cameras focus on the shuttle and the tank, and we see that on the way uphill. NASA TV plans, George, real quick, are we going to follow the boosters down? Are you going to follow the lawn dart?
Yeah, as much as we can see. We're not going to have any cameras offshore that will be live.
Okay.
But we'll be using our long-range tractors at Kennedy Space Center and down at Patrick Air Force Base to see it, as well as some other long-range optics. So we're going to try to be on it and see as much as we can. With those two long-range trackers, we do expect to be able to follow it.
One of the interesting aspects to this is when we separate in a shuttle, the boosters will start to spin normally. Our vehicle is very, very stable because we've added that fifth segment on there. We had to add more tumble motors onto this rocket in order to make sure it tumbles enough, because if it doesn't tumble enough, then the parachutes won't properly deploy.
Okay. And let me ask you this question, and I hope it's not a long answer. I hope it's a simple one. But a lot of us who remember Challenger and saw the boosters split and fly on their own, did we learn anything from that? Did that help us in any way with this Ares to say that this thing, which they used to call the stick, I don't know if they still do, is a workable aerodynamic rocket piece of thing that'll do its thing and stay true?
Well, you've got to remember, since Challenger occurred, we've flown an awful lot of missions, 100 missions since then, and we've continued to improve that solid rocket booster, and all the things that have been learned over all those shuttle missions are absolutely still being put to use when we fly this rocket. So in that sense, yes, the heritage of Challenger continues to play out.
Good. And John, again, the biggest critique, words are my business. The thing that people complain about the most about this flight, of course, is how real is it in simulating the actual Ares 1. This is a four-segment solid rocket booster. The real one will have five. You've got a dummy upper stage, which is basically shaped in the right thing, a big, fancy, full-scale model, right weight, right center of gravity and all that, but it basically doesn't do anything. It's a lawn dart, as you say. Right. How much are we going to learn from this? What are we going to take away from this that's really going to help?
It is staggering how much good stuff we're going to get out of this. When, as you pointed out, the outer mold line of the rocket is just like an Ares 1 rocket. I say just like it. There are a few minor differences, but we know what they are. So we've modeled this with those differences, knowing what they are. When we fly it and we look at our model and we see how it reacts, we know we can then compare our math models we've done along with our wind tunnel models that we've done, and now we've got real flight data to compare it to. Mm-hmm. That has not been done, where you have the sensors in the same locations for the math model, for the wind tunnel, and then a real flight. And so when you do that, we're going to get so much data. It tells us so much.
That's great. Now, so when it launches, when do you declare? Normally we declare success when we arrive in orbit. When do you declare success? And more importantly, are you serving beans at the launch?
We will be serving beans.
Okay,
that has been a topic of discussion.
Okay.
We will have post-launch beans. And success is when the solid rocket booster successfully splashes down.
Okay.
We know the upper stage is going to splash down.
Right. There's no doubt about that. And in the meantime, that's all happening from Launch Complex 39B, Pad 39B. Meanwhile, George Diller at Pad 39A this week.
We will be rolling out to Pad 39A with Atlantis on Wednesday morning.
And still shooting for a November 12th launch?
November the 12th. Now, you know, whether or not that's the launch date, we're targeted for that. But right now there's a lot of other things on the range, so we're kind of trying to work around those. And as you know, when you're dealing with all the other range users, it's kind of like, you know, we're all –
right.
We're all sharing the kitchen.
Right. So it's like which cook has the bigger shoulders right now, you know.
So at any rate, but, you know, right now we're targeting November 12th at 4:04 in the afternoon.
And John, the range, you've got it for a couple of days, I would assume, at least.
With 27th and the 28th is what we have reserved right now.
Okay. Any chance of going beyond that? No, with conflicts yet, or is it?
Oh, if we go beyond that, we'll get back in touch with the range and look for another date.
And go through it again.
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. So the next big event now for Ares 1X is what?
You roll out on the 19th.
It's the rollout on the 19th.
Our final power-up, we've been powered up for the past few weeks testing the electronics inside the rocket. We're powered down right now. We're doing our closeouts where we seal the Ares up. And so now we're going to roll out on the 19th.
Oh, that's great. John, George, thanks so much for this preview of the Ares 1X flight. We're going to be here live covering it, of course, and we'll be back with more information and coverage about it. So thanks, guys, very much.
Jim, thank you very much.
Good. Hey, just want to let you all know, next week my guest will be a former boss of mine, another one, Elliot Pullman, from the Space Foundation in Colorado Springs. We'll be talking about military space with him. We'll be talking about China space with him and the commercial space, a lot of good stuff. So stay tuned for that next week. Elliot Pullman from the Space Foundation. That's it for this week's Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB. Have a great week, everybody.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com.